Good morning. It's 9:06. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn this morning. Well, most of us don't enjoy paying taxes. I would say that none of us enjoy it, except that someone, somewhere, must enjoy it. It's the law of averages. Suffice it to say that most of us also understand that we need to pay our taxes in order to maintain essential government services, even if we don't always agree on what those services are or what they should cost or even who should provide them. For those who have been paying attention to the mounting government deficit and who are uncomfortable with the amount of our national debt being held by foreign governments like China, it's been like waiting for the other shoe to drop. Sooner or later, it will be time to pay the piper. My guest this hour says that the time has come, and he predicts that no matter who is elected president in November, he or she will be forced to raise taxes. And he has 10 reasons why. Paul Farrell is a columnist with DowJonesMarketWatch.com, and he's the author of several books, including Millionaire Code and The Lazy Person's Guide to Investing. He joins us by phone. Good morning and welcome to the program.
Hey, good morning to you. It's good to be here this morning.
Well, I always say it's good to be anywhere this morning. I read your column yesterday, and I immediately emailed it to Rhonda Fanning, the producer for this program, because I took one look at it, and I said, this is definitely man-bites-dog material. I don't think I've seen anyone else writing what you're writing.
I get that quite often, people accusing me of being a little bit too honest and calling everybody's bluff.
Well, for the next 50 minutes, feel free to do exactly that.
Well, I'll tell you what got me started. there was an article and a book called The $3 Trillion War by a former Nobel Prize winner. Who now teaches at Harvard. What he basically said was, you know, and this is a direct quote, I'll tell you, that comes out of the book. The price in blood has been paid by members of the volunteer military. The price in treasure has been financed entirely by borrowing. Get this. This is the line that really said, hey, you know, this is important. This is a springboard for looking at the overall debt issue in the United States again. Then he said, taxes have not been raised to pay for the war. Taxes have not been raised. We have gotten the ever since 9/11, we were told, hey, don't worry about it. Go out, spend, buy, travel. We got to keep the economy going. We have been so narrow-minded, so focused in on keeping the economy alive that we know what's happened since 9/11. The economy's gone into the tank instead. It's gone just the opposite way. We have not. When we went to war in the Second World War, we weren't told that we were supposed to get out there and spend and get big tax cuts out to the rich. What we were told to do back in, and I was around then. I was born in the 30s. We were told that what we had to do was sacrifice, and Americans did sacrifice. America is a strong country that's built on sacrificing and suffering. I mean, how many people did we lose in the, how many military did we lose in the Second World War? Well, over half a million, and God knows. The figures I've seen have been as high as 20 million in terms of the people that were killed in Europe. Well, as far as I can see, and reading articles and reading the book by Joseph Stiglitz and Linda Blims, this party is over. America has had a great indulgence in its excesses, in its denial, in its incompetence, and in its arrogance for exactly too long. And it seems to me that it doesn't matter who becomes president of the United States, the taxes are going to have to go up. There are many things that we just simply have been ignoring. We've been acting as if we can go out and buy Hummers and gas guzzlers and spend money left and right and go into debt and count on the Chinese to pick up the tab. And you know what's happened. You've already mentioned it. The tab has been picked up entirely too long, and the dollar, the American dollar, which used to be the strength of the world, the reserve currency, there are a lot of countries now that are saying, we gotta spread it around. We can't really take the chance of relying on the American dollar being the reserve currency because it's going down in value. This may work out great for American exporting to other countries where they're getting more money there. But in the United States, it isn't working out anymore. This is an economic situation that's backfiring, and I don't look at this as a political issue. I just look at it as if we've gone to such excesses over the past 7 to 10 years, and actually it goes back into the Democratic presidency before that. We have lived high on the hog for entirely too long. When in the former presidency under Clinton, we learned how to live with excess by all the everything that went with the stock market, and the stock market, as you well know, with the dot-com era, collapsed completely. There have been a number of analysis that have been writing and said, you know, in the normal business cycle, going from bear to bull, normally we have a bear market about every 4 to 6 years. This time it's just happening a lot faster. We're back into a cycle now where we have virtually come to face an economic situation that's very similar to the Great Depression. And the problem is, and this is what scares me, this is why I write about situations where I think that we need to face these problems and get into the taxes and face the tax situation now, because if we don't, what's going to happen is in approximately, I say, somewhere in the first term of the next president, we're going to have a collapse of the entire economy. If you think it's bad now, it'll be much worse now. We can't continue to play the kind of games that we've played this past 7 years under the current presidency. One of the key things that this book pointed out, and I had read bits and pieces of this over a period of time, but I read the book and what this Nobel economist is pointing out is that we've not only had a pressure in this country to go ahead, forget about what's going on as far as the war, and get out there and spend and keep the economy going. Part of that whole gimmickry has been hiding the cost, the real cost of what's happening with this war, and this is important. It's worth looking at how we've hidden the cost, because we've been told each quarter, each year, each annual budget coming out of the federal government that the cost is maybe about $800 billion. And remember, we were originally sold this as a war where we were going to be welcomed as liberators.
Oh, yeah, we were going to be in and out, and it was going to be paid for with Iraqi oil.
And it was about $50, $60 billion at the outset. We had a number of key officials that worked in the Treasury and worked under the Secretary of Defense, who literally were fired because they were being honest and they were telling the truth. But the real costs are going to be substantially high. How is the administration hidden these costs? According to this Nobel economist, it hidden them by, instead of putting them in the budget, keeping each of the increases in supplemental financing bills. There's absolutely no estimate of veterans' health care estimates. And I was in Korea. I've been at the VA hospitals and gotten health care. Believe me, when the veterans are taken care of, and many of them, I've seen figures of like 13,000 to 15,000 are seriously wounded and have had legs replaced, et cetera. And the mental strain on the military is going to be, at least the ones that have been through the war, is going to be substantial for the rest of their lives. That's not in any of the budget estimates. Equipment replacement. We've worn out our military, and we keep recycling people in the military 3 and 4 times into deployments in Iraq. Nothing in there about the cost of the increased costs in the State Department, Homeland Security, etc. All those costs suggest that we are at an estimated cost of this war of 3 trillion. $1 trillion so far, and we have some of the candidates saying we're going to be there for the next century. I know there's some dispute about whether he really said that, and it's all the finesse and the rhetoric and the spin that's going on right now. But the fact is, we're going to be there for a while. We know that, and it's going to cost a lot more than this $3 trillion estimate. And that doesn't include everything else has been increased in this whole situation.
The book that you referred to, The $3 Trillion War, by the way, will be the subject of a broadcast next a week from tomorrow, when hopefully Kathleen Dunn will be back doing the show, and she'll have one of the authors on, and they'll be talking about that book tomorrow.
I hope they go into the detail, because the other, beyond the $3 trillion, we have run up a federal debt, gone from a surplus of $5 trillion to a deficit of where our total federal debt is now over $9 trillion, and, you know, approved by Congress. So Congress is a willing co-conspirator in this whole process of spending and spending and spending our future of the future of America. There's a $9 trillion debt. We have to pay interest on that. That's why the China, where everybody's worried about the Chinese having, I think it's $1.3 trillion with just the Chinese. It's no wonder we have so much debt that we now have, whether it's the Middle East countries, the oil-producing countries, or whether it's China and India, the people that have been picking up our debt for a long period of time now are beginning to say, we want some equity, too. It's no wonder our ports are a prime sale item. Foreign countries want equity. They don't want to just debt.
That's something that you bring up in your article, and there are ten. You list 10 reasons why the next president is going to have to raise taxes. One of the things that you talk about in here is that both the Democratic and Republican parties are, mired in narrow ideologies, and you don't really have much confidence that either group would be able to manage the economy of the United States. And you go on to talk about more. I want to make sure that we get to some of the other reasons, because what we've been talking about so far is reason number one, and there are eight others or nine others, and I want to make sure that we talk about those. I also need to give the phone numbers. I didn't do that at the beginning of the program, so I'll do it now, and we'll make space for people to call in and ask their own questions. 800-486-8655. That's a toll-free number, 800-486-8655. In Milwaukee, it's a local call for you. Please use 227-2050, 227-2050. Okay, so we've kind of broadly covered the first reason you list, which basically has a lot of stuff in it about the mismanagement of the economy, our refusal to actually let people know what the real cost of the war is, and we're basically paying for it on a credit card. And sooner or later, that credit card bill is going to come due. Now, you also mention your second reason is that we have a new Wall Street welfare program. Talk about that a little bit.
The concentration on what's been going on with the subprime credit problem in the United States, which is worse than it's reported, because in the same way that a lot of the statistics about the situation with the war funding are taken care of, there's also a lot of underreporting, or let's say hidden costs, that are going on right now on Wall Street. We were very close to having a total collapse, not only of the United States, but of the world global situation. And it came to a head with this bailout that the Fed had with the Bear Stearns situation, which, you know, they were saddled with a lot of debt that they put off their balance sheet, and it was the subprime mortgages that were not worth what they said they were worth, and they were selling them off, not just Bear Stearns, but I'm sure you've read some stories, or people have read stories about how there were countries like Norway, pension funds that had, and government of other countries that had bought the subprime debt that was being sold off by Wall Street. And it was Wall Street that's being, you know, a lot of what I've been reading about in recent weeks has been that Wall Street's getting all the attention. We have a business favorable, a business pro government right now that says, let's bail out Wall Street. Wall Street. Let's bail out Wall Street. And what's been happening, what's been going on is we're bailing out guys that, if you recall last year, they came close to sinking the economy last year and yet paid out, I think the figure I saw, the top figure was $36 to $38 billion in bonuses. And these are the guys that got us into this big trouble.
Well, now, wait a minute. I thought this was a free market economy. So the idea being that if you fail, well, you fail, and that's your fault.
It's a free market as long as Wall Street gets what they want and are able to jack up the prices. It's a free market as long as they get what they want. But when it turns around and they're in trouble, then they want government subsidies. However, and we've been bailing them out. Now, it looks like, well, the Fed came in there and the Fed is taking over this debt with Bear Stearns. Bear Stearns is arranging to sell off, or the Fed is arranging to sell off Bear Stearns, but they're taking over something like $30 billion worth of bad debts. And that's money that the taxpayer is going to have to take. So this is not a problem that just simply relieving them. But we are on a welfare-type program taking care of Wall Street and stockholders. Meanwhile, we're saying to the individual investors who and the homeowners who are in dire trouble, going through foreclosure, et cetera, that there's no program for you. Well, fortunately, in the last few days, we've begun seeing surface something that's coming out of the Senate that says, hey, we need a bipartisan arrangement that at least do something. Frankly, I'm not as sanguine about that. I think that it's very possible that once it gets through the House, it may be watered down. Once it gets to the president, it could even be vetoed. And when the program is all put together, it's probably not going to help people fast enough who are going through foreclosure right now. We have a huge, I think it's over a million people that are into foreclosure and going to be forced into it as interest rates continue to work against them in terms of the resets on their ATM mortgages.
We're going to take a few phone calls in just a moment. We need to take a break right now, and when we come back, we'll have some calls and some questions. And gosh, we still have eight reasons to go, and we're already more than a third of the way through the program. Lots to talk about here today. The title of the article is 10 Reasons the New President Will Raise Your Taxes. 800-486-8655 and 227-2050 are the phone numbers. Stand by. The lines are full now, but they'll be opening up shortly as we start to go through the calls when we come back. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 25 minutes after 9 o'clock, you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Here's what's coming up later on today on the Ideas Network. After 2 on Talk of the Nation, determining the meaning to society of Martin Luther King Jr.'s life and death. That's after 2 o'clock this afternoon on the Ideas Network. Well, this hour we're talking about taxes and how likely it is that the next president, whoever he or she might be, will have to raise them. And my guest is Paul Farrell, a columnist with DowJonesMarketWatch.com. And by the way, if you want to read Paul's columns, you can go to MarketWatch.com. And all the columns are right there. You can find them and read them all. He's also the author of several books, including The Millionaire Code and Lazy Person's Guide to Investing. That'd be the one I'd need. Okay, so we are talking with our listeners as well. I said we'd go to the phones, and indeed we will. Let's go first to Zach in Green Bay. Zach, good morning.
Good morning. The reason that I want to bring up that I believe we will need to raise taxes is the ongoing military budget separate from the war. It's my understanding that we currently have to pay for 100 permanent military bases in over 130 countries. It's my understanding that much of the weaponry that we pay for does nothing against terrorism, but is in fact designed to battle an old Soviet army. I think our current situation is the military-industrial complex on steroids, and beyond the worst nightmares of President Dwight Eisenhower, who warned us about this. And I think that the worst aspect of this is that there is nearly zero discussion of this entire issue in the mainstream media.
Thanks for the call, Zach. Mr. Farrell, care to respond to that?
Yeah, it reminded me of something that Kevin Phillips, who's written many more books than I have, he was an advisor to Nixon. So he was on the conservative side, but he's been questioning a lot about what's been going on in our government for a long time. And there's something he said back a number of years ago, and I'm quickly trying to find his quotation. Kevin Phillips said, let me see if I can get the exact quotation, because he said that we are, here's the direct quote. It comes out of his book, Wealth and Democracy. He said, most great nations at the peak of their economic power become arrogant and wage great wars at great cost, wasting vast resources, taking on huge debt, and ultimately burning themselves out. He used the examples of course, Rome extending its military way beyond what they should, and while the people back home became fat cats fighting in extreme fighting in the Colosseum, etc. But Zach is really put his finger on something that's very important. This book, The $3 Trillion War, is interesting in its context, but we have a broader issue here. I have a doctorate in psychology, so a lot of what I look at as if almost the United States were a patient and as a psychological problem. We have had a nation that somehow or another bought the whole idea that we can continue spending and spending and spending and living on credit cards. It reminds me very much of teenagers who get drunk for the first time and take their parents' car and take their parents' credit cards and get into a hell of a lot of trouble. This is where we have been for a couple of decades now, and it continues to get out of hand. So when Kevin Phillips or when Zach asks this question, it is a very important question. And it's not a matter of just simply saying that we're going to go in and change the politics and change a government and put in a new president. It goes beyond that. Somehow or another, we have been brainwashing ourselves and buying into this idea that we can continue to live and just like this quotation from Kevin Phillips, who really has written a lot of very important books since leaving the Nixon administration a long time ago.
Let's take a call, Nick.
We're a great nation. We're at the peak of our economic power. We are arrogant. Things have gone to our head. We are waging great wars, wasting assets, and taking on huge debts. And we are in danger of burning ourselves out.
Let's take a call next from Joe in Winona, Minnesota. Joe, good morning.
Hello.
Hi, Joe. You're on.
Hi. I would just like to ask if, I'd like to correct him. Richard Nixon was nothing of a conservative. Do you ever believe there's a time to cut taxes?
Is there ever a time to cut taxes?
Yes.
That's really a very good point, because there always is a time to cut taxes. I don't know whether I'm not going to get into the stuff about whether you should cut the taxes on the rich or cut the taxes on the middle class right now. But I will point out, and this was one of the five reasons that I said we're going to have to increase taxes, that we, in addition to everything else that's going on with the spending on the war and the increasing federal debt and the trade deficit, which is totally out of hand right now, in order to support the economic engine of the United States, we have a system that's grown up. I don't know how many people are aware of this, but the whole business of Washington lobbying did not start until the middle 70s, around the time of the Nixon administration. The lobbying machine was started from ground zero to push through these earmark, where special interest groups who are the lobbyists would push through special interests that would support particular tax cuts for, say, the pharmacy industry, or it would support a particular exhibit that would occur in some state somewhere because a particular congressman would want to have that inserted into the budget. And the reason that this is important is that the lobbying industry in America, and the Washington Post did a series last year, and they called the lobbying is Washington's biggest business. Washington's biggest business. Today there's something like, get this, 35,000 lobbyists in Washington, D.C. And you know how many elected officials there are? There's only 537. We have Congress. The representatives are 437. There are senators, 100 senators. There's a president and a vice president. That's all the elected people. And they're pretty much kowtowing to lobbyists who put up most of the money for their campaigns. I mean, even Senator McCain is saying that he has never taken any earmarks, but the fact is that his entire campaign is being run by lobbyists right now. So that it does, and the other two senators who are running for president are also funded and beholden to a lot of the lobbyists. So we have an enormous situation today where I think one of the main reasons that we're having trouble, and it's going to explode and backfire on the entire American taxpayer, is the situation that's occurred with the lobbyists in America. There's so much pressure and there's so much greed, and I say that with capital letters, greed, of individual groups trying to get what's best for their particular special interest lobby, whatever it happens to be. And I've got a book that's coming out sometime next year that's going to be discussing this along with a lot of other issues about how America is mired in greed, driving them to get what every individual can. There's very little, I think, very little interest in our government to take care of the country as a whole. It's more about what can we get. Even when we had Katrina, it's a lot of lobbyists were trying to get people. Get the government to buy their trailers, or when we're in the war, it's a matter of supporting particular defense contractors because they think that, for example, the Osprey or some other or keep the replacement for the Humvees out of Iraq. There were all kinds of competition that are going on in the defense industry. It's looking at the overall picture right now.
Let's go next to a call from Mike in Appleton. Mike, good morning.
Yeah, good morning. I agree with a lot of what your guest is saying, especially the greed part. Just three very quick points, and perhaps kind of simplistic, but you know, for simplistic minds to help us understand a very complicated issue. First, kind of in response to what one of your previous callers, Zach, said about you know our military structure. The fact of the matter is that probably within a short period of time, we're going to be seriously challenged by China, so we unfortunately have to be ready for that. If we pull back, we create a vacuum, and laws of physics, a vacuum will always be filled, point number one. Point number two, looking at the world's economy, let's look at China, let's look at Japan, let's look at Europe. Isn't it kind of true that we all have each other sort of like by the short hairs in the sense that, you know, if this economy disappears, what are the Chinese going to do? Who are they going to sell their products to? So it would seem to me that if it came to a crunch, the Chinese would probably be the first to want to help. And my third point is with regards to the $3 trillion war, to me it seems that by having a presence in the region, it's not Iraq and the democracy. I mean, by having a presence in the region, we're keeping our thumb on the control of oil, and, you know, 90% of the world's oil is in that region. And by doing so, we're probably still paying $3.25 a gallon here. I think that if we weren't there, if we didn't have a military presence there, and this oil was controlled by these people who would be capable of putting it at $200 a barrel, we'd probably be paying $8 or $9 a gallon at the pump. So maybe what's happening there is that the actual cost, the actual real price of the gasoline is being camouflaged by the cost of the war. Sorry for all the points.
Well, I'm going to come back and I'm going to quote, and this was in my article, I quoted a comment in Newsweek magazine by Dan Gross. And the title of his article was, it's a one-pager, called Mismanagement 101. And here's the direct quote of what he said. As oil hovered near $100 a barrel, President Bush complained to OPEC about the high oil prices. OPEC President Khalid Khalil responded acidly that the crude's remarkable run had nothing. Crude's remarkable run had nothing to do with the reluctance of the Persian Gulf nations to pump oil, and everything to do with the mismanagement of the United States economy. That was a comment made by the president of OPEC to the president of the United States, telling him that we have mismanaged the United States economy. Your question is, your points are extremely valid. There's a nuance here about how much you can. For example, I agree with you 100%. We need to keep a strong military. How strong, though? One of the problems that was written up in Kevin Phillips' book and a number of others. There was a vice chairman of Goldman Sachs wrote a book that I reviewed about a year ago about the funding of Americans' military going back to Hamilton at the start after the Revolutionary War. That we need to take care of our debts. We need to have a strong military. We need to be prepared to fight. I was in Korea. And I understand. I volunteered to go to Korea with the Marine Corps. We need to have a strong military. And yes, we need to count on our friends. I think that President Bush is doing a good thing trying to get NATO beefed up. We need to have a strong presence there. But we also need to treat them right instead of screwing around as I think we have been with a lot of the people who have been in the coalition of the willing. In the Iraq War, I don't think we have properly handled our relationships with other military, with other countries and other militaries, nor with the American people. Honestly, telling us that we need to sacrifice. I mean, this is another point that I bring up is the savings rate in the United States because of our emphasis in the past 7 years during the fighting of a war on continuing the economy and having no sacrifice. It's been part of a cycle that started back in the 80s, the decline of consumer savings and the increase of consumer spending. Our savings rate back in the early 80s was above 10%. It is currently in negative territory. Not only are we borrowing too much from foreign countries, but the American consumer is borrowing too much to live high on the hog. I mean, this may sound like a diversion, but yesterday I read something. I handed it to my wife, and I said, look at this. There's a six-year-old girl who's a gymnast, and she's at some national competition, and all of the cosmetic companies are there. They're handing out free cosmetics to hook these young gals at a very early age to a lifestyle that may be detrimental in the long run, may help the economy, may help the cosmetic companies in the same way that drug companies hand out a lot of free drugs. But it doesn't work in the long run. I like the point that the caller was making, is we have to have some kind of a balance between our economy, the strength of our military, and our ability to spend and enjoy the prosperity that the United States has brought us after 227 years. But we can't go to excess. I was looking for, there was a comment that Warren Buffett made in Fortune magazine back about, I don't know, I'd say maybe 4 or 5 years ago. And he said, you know, the United States is very much like a farmer in Nebraska who is living high on the hog, And in order to fund their lifestyle, what they're doing is selling off the back 40 and then another back 40 and then another back 40 and going into debt at the same time. And at some point, you ain't got no more back 40 to sell. And this is what's happening here in the United States. We've seen the decline of the dollar, and a lot of it has to do with the fact that we've been living high on the hog, selling off the back 40.
The point about the price of oil, my understanding is that at this point in time, and it hasn't always been this case, but at this point in time, the price of oil is pretty much determined by the speculators in the market and what they're willing to bet on the future price of oil or some situation someplace, and that really we're way past the point where the OPEC countries say, here's how much oil is today. The speculators are in control of the cost of oil.
Well, it's a good, again, a good question. We live, the interesting thing about economics, and I spent 6 years with Morgan Stanley in New York in the investment banking business. A lot of my training has been in economics. And we look at this stuff, there's some kind of a stasis or a balance point where all of this comes together. And you're right, it isn't. In the short run, we have OPEC is making decisions of how to take advantage or not take advantage of oil price increases. And yes, on the other hand, we have this other factor in the equation. That's the speculators and the traders. They're going every time there's any kind of a uncertainty or instability somewhere in Tibet or wherever it happens to be, the price of oil may increase. If there's some, in Nigeria, something goes off the rails, the price of oil goes up or down. The speculators continue in there. But we were my gas bills on my car were somewhere around in the 20s, 20, 25, not too long ago, a few years ago. Today, if I go out there and fill up my tank, it's going to be close to $50. I don't care whether you want to blame that on the traders, whether you want to blame it on OPEC. The fact is, we have an American psyche that's gone off the track. I happen to be a recovering alcoholic. I've been sober now for going on 35 years. The fact is, I see in America signs of us being very much like an unrecovered alcoholic who really needs to go into rehab, really needs to have someone do an intervention on us and say, hey, and this is why I started out by saying it doesn't matter who the next president is going to be, that we're going to have the United States go into some kind of rehab. I mean, another one of the points that I bring up is this point, the point about this huge resistance in America to do something about Social Security and not too long ago giving us this extra drug benefit and tying into the drug benefit program is a fact that says we cannot even negotiate. The government can't even negotiate the price. This, you talk about a free market system. How can our government set up a system where there's absolutely no ability to negotiate in a free market system the cost of the drugs that are going to occur and being paid for by Medicare? This makes absolutely no sense. We're looking at unfunded entitlement programs in the United States with Medicare, Medicaid, the drug program, Social Security, in the range of $50 to $75 trillion, and that's going to happen a lot faster than we think. A piece I wrote several months ago to say, you know, at some point, the young people who are getting stuck with this bill are going to say, hey, this is no longer acute a situation where you boomers are leaving us with the bills. We don't like this, and there's going to be a revolt in the United States. That's another one of the factors that I tie into this. ARP and others are going to fight any kind of cutbacks, but the economists, and I've seen several, and I think one of them is now working in the Congressional Budget Office, are telling us that unless we do something about the situation just with Medicare, Medicaid, with the bills that are piling up, we're going to wind up with, get this, increases in our taxes of over 40% or cuts in our benefits of 40%. We cannot continue doing what we're doing. This is the situation is getting totally out of hand. We're going to have a revolt of the young people. We're certainly getting a revolt in other areas where people are constantly saying we can't continue to live this way. It's a psychological phenomenon, and this country needs to go into some kind of a rehab situation, and it's going to hurt. We're going to find out that come the next presidency, we're going to have a lot of people that are hurting.
And we're going to have to take a break here and come back, and I've got a whole bunch of people on the phone who want to talk to you and talk to the rest of us as well, and we want to get to those. So let's take a quick break. When we come back, we'll take some phone calls and spend some more time talking. Well, it's kind of gloom and doom, but I'm not ready to ask Reverend Jim to pass the Kool-Aid just yet, but we'll find out more when we come back after this break. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 11 minutes before 10 o'clock. Coming up after 10, I'll be talking to a guest who wants to discuss a recent report that compares federal dollars given to each state for public health. It indicates that only 5 states received less funding than Wisconsin last year from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention for public health programs. Well, this hour we're talking about our taxes and how likely they are to go up no matter who becomes the next president or who's in Congress. They're all going to face the same world. And my guest says that we really aren't going to have any choice about raising taxes because the bills are going to come due and somebody's going to have to pay them. We're talking with Paul Farrell, a columnist and an economist. He's with DowJonesMarketWatch.com. He's the author of several books, including Millionaire Code and The Lazy Person's Guide to Investing. We have full phone banks, and I want to try and get to as many calls as I can in the last 8 or 9 minutes of the program here, so I'm going to ask everybody to please be as concise as possible.
Including me.
that will help us get more questions.
You know, can
questions
I say something just quickly?
Sure, go ahead.
You said that you mentioned the term doom and gloom. You know, I think that the United States has gotten by. We've gone into this psychological overdrive like an alcoholic, and I'm really looking very excited at what the prospects are. The United States was based on sacrifice, on being strong, had a strong military, on standing up, on being independent and entrepreneurial, and I think that when this happens, when we go into, quote, rehab, as I use the term, we're going to have a whole new country going back to what we were before, what we really are as a nation. Anyway, let's go to the questions. This is not
okay.
Doom and gloom.
Okay, all right. Well, you know, I'm not only a cynic, I'm generally a pessimist. So let's go. It's a bad combination. And I live in a place that doesn't get a lot of sunshine in the wintertime. Let's go next to Mary in Baraboo. Mary, good morning.
Good morning, and thank you for the show. It's incredible. I agree with the guest completely. I agree that the next president is going to be a very unpopular president, no matter who it is. But the thing I haven't heard mentioned is, when is the Congress going to become unpopular and start making some of the decisions that have to be made to straighten it out? Because if I overspend, if I overborrow, I lose my house, I go bankrupt. In essence, that's what the country's doing. When is the Congress going to open up their eyes, or do we need to vote a new Congress in? And what can be done? Thank you. I'll take my answer off the air.
Excellent question. I think, interestingly, it starts at the top, and we've had a certain attitude at the top for the past 7 years that has really browbeaten both sides of the aisle in Congress. Both the Republicans and the Democrats have taken their lead from a spend and borrow president, I'm not making this up. This is in fact what's been going on there. So that the Republicans shake their head yes like bobble dolls and have been anything that the president and the administration wants, they've gone along with, and the Democrats are restricted, I guess, because of the need to override a veto with the 2/3 vote, so that nothing's gotten done, and it's all been at the top by a president and administration that's wanted to increase the power of the executive. That's okay, but we have a government. we have a government that's supposed to have a balance of power. And you've raised an excellent question. I hope that the senators and the congressmen that we get in have some guts. And I haven't seen much guts. What I've seen is people that are out there that are being run by these 35,000 lobbyists who all want to say to every, they're saying this to every senator. Why are you people in Wisconsin close to the bottom in terms of it? You probably are not aggressive enough and greedy enough to push your lobbyists and your congressmen to get your, quote, fair share, if you want to call it that. This is... When I talk about the about America having somehow or another degraded itself psychologically and becoming very much like a unrecovered alcoholic, we need to go into rehab. And this is another one. Your point is well taken. It's another manifestation of what I'm talking about.
I'm wondering who's going to do the intervention. Let's go to William next in Middleton. William, good morning. Thanks for hanging on.
I lived in Chicago when Chicago was burning. I went to Detroit and saw the burning there. America is not going to be saved by counting on sugar daddies who control these politicians. The people themselves are going to have to start the bonfires again. The elected officials agreed after 1945 that to pay off America's debt, they would increase the tax rate up to as high as 96%. And we paid off our debts. And lastly, both houses, Republicans, and ding-dong Clinton repealed the Glass-Steagall Act of
1933. The Glass-Steagall Act of 1933 was repealed. Thanks for that, William.
Yeah, and again, I agree with William. I wrote about that. I think that was one of the biggest mistakes. We should have kept the investment banking and commercial banking separate. Unfortunately, that's why Wall Street has built up to a point where they've got their greed has just gone up in smoke almost. Because I don't know whether people are aware of it. There is a whole what is now called a quote shadow banking system of $516 trillion that floats around throughout the world. And a lot of what's being done on Wall Street is trading on derivatives in this shadow banking system, and it's outside of the Federal Reserve. I mean, the Federal Reserve can do all they're talking about right now, but in the end, what they've done is they've thrown to the American taxpayer a lot of debt that the Wall Street accumulated while they're playing this game in the shadow banking system, which has no regulation and requires no reserves. So things are getting so out of hand there. And then the taxpayer, like this last caller talked about, the taxpayer is picking it up. Are we at the point where we can actually do something about it? It may be that we're beyond the point and nothing is going to be. We don't have the strength in Congress to really say that they're no longer going to be responsive to the lobbyists out there.
Well, we've got about...
I wish I wasn't just sounded. This is to me that has nothing to do with politics. Both sides are remiss. Both sides are acting like unrecovered alcoholics, as far as I'm concerned.
We've got about a minute and a half left before we have to get out of here. So I want we're not going to get to all your reasons why the next president is going to have to raise our taxes. But what would you say can be done? Give us some hope to get out of here on today.
If I want to give anybody any hope, I think this last caller hit it on the head. I mean, he has the same kind of a sense of rage that I do about what's been going on. I try to contain it, try to write about it in as strictly as possible, and analyzing it as possible as economics rather than politics. But I think he's absolutely right. We need some kind of a grassroots revolution in the United States. And until that happens, we're going to continue on our merry way with 35,000 lobbyists running and telling 537 elected officials in the United States. We need people that are going to get out there and say, hey, we can't take this anymore. We are ready and willing to bite the bullet in the United States and get back to our roots from 1776 on and start paying our bills, start taking responsibility for what this really is an individual thing. Congressmen, do you know how many of these lobbyists, over half of our elected officials, your senators and your and your representatives, half of them, they make big cushy perks and retirement benefits, and then they go off, and half of them become lobbyists and make hundreds of thousands to millions of dollars a year as lobbyists trying to get money back to their constituency or whoever will pay the amount of money. These guys make a huge amount of money, and that's what's really controlling this country. We need to have some kind of a grassroots revolution that comes forward here and says, we can't take it any longer. Like that movie
we're network. We're mad as hell and we're not going to take it anymore from Network.
Screaming out there like network where he says, get out, put your head outside the window and scream, I can't take it anymore. I've had it.
Okay. Okay, well, we're out of time, so we can't take it anymore here either. Thank you so much. It's been a very informative and sobering hour.
Thank you. It was my pleasure being on.
Paul Farrell is a columnist for MarketWatch.com and author of several books, including The Millionaire Code and Lazy Person's Guide to Investing. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this program and John Treader for answering the phones. I'm John Munson. This is the Ideas Network.